Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Today on Sticks In, we are back, and we're going to roll through some fall ball. I went to the Callaloy Classic up at Hofstra, so we'll talk about what I saw there, some other fall ball competition that is already underway and happening, and of course, the big news from Monday, LA has officially recommended lacrosse for Olympic inclusion in 2028. Huge day for the sport. Huge day for all fans of the sport. Let's do it. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Sticks In. Thank you so much for joining me today. We haven't had an episode, really, since the Premier Lacrosse Championship game recap. A lot has happened since then, most notably the biggest news, the news that came out today on Monday, if you're listening to this, came out yesterday. Los Angeles has recommended that lacrosse be included in the 2028 Olympic Games. Los Angeles, the committee in LA that's organizing the games, has recommended that we include lacrosse in the 2028 games. So it's on the list along with baseball, softball, cricket, and squash. About a week from now, next week, the IOC will vote officially on those sports being included. In all likelihood, it goes forward. And lacrosse at that point will officially be on the field in LA in 2028. So, I mean, obviously, that's just massive for a number of reasons. Lacrosse hasn't been played for a medal at the Olympics in over 100 years. 1908, I think, is the last year they played lacrosse for a medal. It's been a demonstration sport since then. I believe most recently back in like the 40s. Demonstration sport, there's no medals conferred or anything like that. They just, you know, they play. It's what it sounds like. Demonstration. There's really been an effort to get the sport back into the Olympics for essentially my entire life, for decades. So now that it feels like, you know, we're going to see lacrosse played in the Olympics for medals, I am overjoyed, absolutely overjoyed. Olympic lacrosse is going to be sixes, as I'm sure everyone knows. So we as Americans, that means we have 5 years to figure out how to beat Canada. If you recall the World Games in Birmingham, Canada there basically just beat the holy hell out of absolutely everybody. They were just on a different level playing at that point. You know, at the World Games, at that point, the Sixes was basically brand spanking new still. Those games were the first, I think, really the first like serious competition for a lot of players and coaches within the format. So people were like just learning as they went pretty much and trying to figure out how it would work. A lot's going to be learned about the, you know, the scheme, the tactics, the X's and O's, roster construction, all that between today, October 9th, 2023, and when they take the field in LA 5 years from now. Of course, I immediately start thinking about like the 2028 players. I'm like, oh my God, who's going to be on this Olympic roster? And it's like 5 years from now, you're thinking, all right, like Joey Spallina is going to be a year or two out of school. Brennan O'Neill, Connor Schellenberger, it'll be a team probably belonging to that core of guys, right? And like your Matt Rambos, your Matt Dunns, those guys are going to be like your veteran leaders who are still there on the team. It's wild to think about it that way. So, you know, those players who are going to be entering their primes as pros are guys who aren't even playing pro lacrosse yet. Those are going to be those Olympic, you know, top tier players. And, you know, thinking about that too, it almost made me a little bit sad, to think about all the great American players who have been part of this push towards the Olympics and will never get their chance to actually play in the Olympics. Yes, lacrosse has world championships. Those are special. Those are meaningful. Everybody who's won a gold in that is going to cherish that gold. It's the closest thing we've had to the Olympics in lacrosse, but the Olympics is the Olympics. When it comes to global athletic competition, there is nothing like it, save maybe the World Cup in soccer. Nothing else comes close. So, you know, you think about those guys who have been doing it over these, you know, past several years. Like, will Rob Pennell be able to get back out there in 5 years and play in the Olympics? I don't know. You know, Paul Vabel's already retired. He and a bunch of folks in the PLL have been a big part of the push towards the Olympics with time, with resources, with effort and everything. So he's a guy who's never going to get to play in an Olympics. And you think about the career of guys like that, like all-time greats who are pushing this sport towards Olympic inclusion, and they'll never get the chance to wear red, white, and blue and maybe get an Olympic medal. So that part of it, you know, that did make me like a little bit, you're still happy because it's lacrosse in the Olympics. It's still great. But, you know, I just found myself thinking about some of those greats from world championships past who will not get a chance to do what this and participate in this thing they set in motion with their efforts to get lacrosse in the Olympics. So, you know, like Tom Schreiber, I think, is, if my math is right, is going to be in the neighborhood of like 36 years old when the Olympics get here. I hope he's out there on that stage for the U.S. 36 is, it's doable. I mean, he just won an MVP at, you know, 30, 31, something like that. So, he still clearly got it, you know, 5 years from now. I hope he's out there, because he's the kind of guy who you would want to see, you know, as maybe like a captain or a leader of that first team in the Olympics. He's that caliber of person. So, I mean, obviously roster-wise, this is really all just kind of aspirational. There's no real point in trying to surmise who will or won't be there. Like, there's anybody who's writing an article like the potential Team USA roster, like, there's no point. It's 5 years from now. No, we don't know. We have no idea. It's all just like fantasy and fun. But of course, it's where your mind goes. If you're like me, it's where your mind goes. You think immediately about who's going to be out there and how cool it's going to be. So, Olympic inclusion, continuing just kind of talk about this and what it means a little bit. The opportunity for the explosion of lacrosse growth here is massive. I'm going to make maybe the safest bet in the universe. Lacrosse is going to have its most watched television broadcast ever at the Olympics when those get here. You can book it. It's like the last Olympic games, the summer games, we'll do, you know, there was the Beijing, I think it was in 2022, but those are winter. It's not a fair comp. The last summer games, Tokyo 2020, even though they did it in 2021 because of COVID, had a global audience viewership of over 3 billion people with a B. 3 billion people watched those Olympics in Tokyo. It's one of the lowest watched Olympics ever with that size audience. They averaged 15.5 million viewers every single night for the Olympics. And again, those are very down Olympic broadcast numbers. That's one of the lowest, if not the lowest, watched Olympics ever. And I mean, obviously it's like you want that trend to be reversed. You want people to watch the Olympics. Them being in LA might help, you know, in terms of getting American eyeballs on it or whatever, but those numbers for lacrosse are insane. Nobody tunes in for lacrosse like that. So, you know, bad ratings by Olympic standards are still out of this world audience sizes for growing sports like lacrosse and a number of these other sports who are still getting into, you know, trying to get that recognition. So the sport just hasn't had that opportunity to be in front of that many people like that before. It just hasn't. Where it was like, it's there. The marquee sporting event on earth that's going to be on a bazillion different channels for whoever it is that carries the Olympics. I think it's still NBC. I think they still have 2028, but it's going to be special to have that amount of people just in terms of pure potential for an audience for people to watch and hopefully fall in love with the game. So the last time lacrosse was in the Olympics for medal competition, TV hadn't been invented yet. Like, this is uncharted territory. So people all over the world have the ability to tune in with a TV, with from your computer, from your phone, from whatever, any screen you have. It's such an insane opportunity. Obviously, there's, you know, there's resources that come. There's the validation of the sport in general. Paul Vrabel at PLL Championship Weekend kind of spoke about both those things as the big bonus that comes with Olympic inclusion. Man, to me, that's a bit, it's a billion eyeballs watching the Olympics that are going to see lacrosse. Billions of people over the course of those 2 weeks of the Olympics or whatever it is. It's such an incredible opportunity. There's, of course, there's things I wonder about when it comes to the Olympics that'll have to be sorted out between 2028 and now. The first thing, and I'm sure a lot of people have already started wondering about it, talking about it, even maybe calling for action about it, but what happens with the Haudenosaunee? I feel like, me personally, if there's a situation other than they're allowed to compete as their own nation under their own flag for lacrosse, that has to be how it is. Anything else is unacceptable. They are the people who brought this sport to the world, and now the world is going to be playing it on the biggest athletic stage that there is. The Haudenosaunee should be there participating in their colors under their flag, like proud of this, what's become global game. You know, you have 70 plus members of World Lacrosse. People are going to be trying to qualify for these Olympics, to play in these Olympics. They're all playing this game that the Haudenosaunee brought to all of us. Whatever has to happen between now and 2028 so that they can travel, have their passports recognized, and compete under their own flag, we need to find a way to make it happen. As I understand it, the Olympic Charter requires countries to be recognized within the international community to be, like, recognized at the Olympics. And I think that typically entails, like, are you a member of the UN? The Haudenosaunee are not, so I don't know if they're... I don't think they're a recognized nation right now. Back in 1904, apparently, there was like a Mohawk Indians, in air quotes, team that competed. I'm not going to pretend to know every in and out and know the history and know about all this. I just know that there's going to be miles of red tape around this kind of thing. And you want it to work out so that the Haudenosaunee can travel as their own country and be respected and celebrated as part of lacrosse being there, and the rest of the world playing their game. So, you know, there's that part of it that, of course, is going to be on everybody's mind between now and then, how that all gets worked out. The next thing I was thinking about was, what do we see in terms of Six's events between now and L.A.? Obviously, now it's going to make sense to really ramp up the Six's play we see as the Olympics get closer, because it's the new lacrosse format. It's what's going to be played in the Olympics. But there's not a whole lot of events that are Six's events right now. You have the PLL and the championship series. I think that alone is going to be an interesting one, because now that we have this lacrosse in the Olympics being much more firm, will the championship series still be played with kind of those modified PLL Six's rules? Or does this make more sense to strictly go, hey, this is the Olympic rule set. We're going to play the Olympic rule set because it's time to start gearing up for LA. The PLL, you know, they love to have their own spin on things, their own way of doing things, and their own way of kind of speeding the game up or changing the pace or whatever they want to do to kind of, you know, make it their own and put their own kind of branding on it. But showcasing what's going to be in the Olympics exactly as it's going to be in the Olympics, is that more valuable to the sport than whatever the, you know, the adding of the 2-point line or any of the other stuff? But beyond the championship series, how else are we going to watch and experience Six's in the next 5 years? What other events are going to be in store for us? The answer can't be nothing, right? You can't just have some local small events and then the, you know, a PLL event every February for the next 5 years until the Olympics get here. Like, if we're in the Olympics now to play Six's, we got to start playing some more Six's. We got to see it. We got to put it in front of people between now and then. So I'm excited to see what kind of Six's events we get as we get closer to 2028. You know, are there going to be more World Games type events when we get to the, you know, the next World Championships? Are we going to be doing, is there going to be a Six's discipline to it? You know, separate from field, I would hope not replacing field, but, you know, how do we put Six's in front of more people in the next 5 years so it's not this thing that you know, is totally brand new again, even to seasoned lacrosse viewers. Last thing I was thinking about was, as much as I am enjoying this now, and I am very much enjoying looking forward to lacrosse in the Olympics, when do we start working on 2032? Because lacrosse, getting in for LA, does not mean lacrosse is in forever. It's not like it's a permanent, it's in the Olympics now, forever thing. Next week, when the IOC hopefully makes it official, let's party, let's celebrate, let's be excited, let's start getting ready for our LA travel. But then I think the job kind of becomes, all right, we got to keep lacrosse an Olympic sport. After LA, we want to make sure lacrosse is still in the Olympics when we go to Australia in 2032. You know, the people who worked as hard as they did to make this happen for 2028, this is not news to them. They are well aware of this. Whether lacrosse got in for LA or not, the effort to 2032 is always going to be something that started quickly. But now, when does it start and what does that effort look like? Is it, all right, the focus needs to be on, we need to crush 2028 and knock it out of the park so that lacrosse people can say, hey, IOC, look how great this was and look how big of a success it was. Let's do it again. Let's keep it around for the Olympics. Or is it a different lobbying process from that? Like, these aren't hypotheticals. Like, I'm asking these questions because I legitimately don't know the answers. I'm excited to try and dig into it and find out the answers and hopefully be part of helping. But again, it, you know, it took decades to get here. And it's only 9 years till 2032. So I don't want to sound like a doomer planning for the next Olympics before we've had this one, but I don't care. Breakdancing got into the Olympics and immediately dropped right back out. I don't want to be one and done for lacrosse. I don't want to, you know, see that happen. I don't know how to help keep it in the Olympics, but I want to make sure we keep it in the Olympics, and I want to do whatever I can to keep it there. We've got 5 years to pump this up, to get excited. I can't wait. I know it's going to be here before we know it. I'm determined to go to LA for these games. There's no way I miss it. I'm going to go and be watching lacrosse, and I'm doing it because I have no idea if I'll ever have the chance to see lacrosse in the Olympics again. So, that was the biggest news of the day so far. I was so excited. Very happy for the folks at World Lacrosse. Guys like Jim Scherer have been, you know, they've been busting their ass for years to get to this day. So, you know, very happy for them and very happy for lacrosse fans everywhere. You know, in a week, it'll be official. It sounds like it's, you know, the vote will almost certainly, you know, likely approve all five sports that were recommended. And then we start getting ready to watch lacrosse in the Olympics, man. First time in my lifetime I'm going to see it. So I am excited. On a much smaller scale from the Olympics, it is fall ball time. Really, it's been fall ball time. I got to head to my first fall ball event of the year over the weekend. I braved the wind, I braved the rain, the Throgs Neck Bridge, the whole deal, to head out to Hofstra, check out the Colalori Classic, which benefits the Headstrong Foundation. It's always a really cool event. A lot of schools will host events for the Headstrong Foundation, but having it at Hofstra, given that Nick played there and is, you know, a founder and everything, makes it more special to me to get the chance to go see it when it's at Hofstra and when they do their event every year. So was excited to go out and see that. The teams that played this year were Bucknell, Monmouth, Lehigh, Hopkins, and of course Hofstra. So you got some talented squads out there. You know, Lehigh is a fun and intriguing team, because they have a new coach. You know, they have some of their top players from a year ago have graduated or transferred or moved on. Obviously, Hopkins is a team with probably Final Four aspirations this year. Hofstra was a young group last year, and brings back a ton of their returning brings back a ton of weapons. So I was excited to see some of those guys play. You know, Bucknell has some really talented offensive players out there, and I've never had a chance to see Monmouth play in person. So, you know me, just a junkie for the sport. I will take an opportunity to see something new in lacrosse every chance I get. You know, the format was kind of everybody played two games in a row except for Hofstra. Hofstra played the first game of the day and the last game of the day, but Bucknell played two games back-to-back. Their second game was against Monmouth. Their first game was against Hofstra, so it was Hofstra and Monmouth for Bucknell, and then Monmouth, after playing Bucknell, played Lehigh. And then Lehigh, after playing Monmouth for their second game, played Hopkins. And then Hopkins played Lehigh, and then Hofstra. So everybody played two games in a row, except for Hofstra, who played first and last. And it's fall ball. It was, you know, score resets every quarter, 15 minutes, quarters, with the fourth quarter being running time. Teams got, you know, kind of their starters and their young guys mixed through, getting everybody in the lineup for the most part. Play was kind of sloppy, but, you know, you got to see, I thought, some really good play and some really good players. You saw glimpses of what these teams are aspiring to be, I think, come February. You know, Bucknell, they return basically their top four scorers from last year. Dutch Furlong is back. He is to me their best offensive player. He ran out of the midfield a little bit. He played from X a little bit. He's very versatile, very creative. But Will Hopkins, Connor Davis, Cam Doolin. I thought Michael Meyer looked really, really good. He's a big physical dodger. You know, they kind of put him at X a lot of the time and just let him, you know, take his matchup and see if he can get to the island and create from there. But all of them, you know, had multiple goals over the course of two games. Hopkins is quite the garbage man. He must have had three or four garbage goals on the day where it was just like rebound and he's just all over it. He was all over the ball. If your goalie did not make a clean save, he was going to be there for it. So they did have a couple of really nice freshmen. Peter Grandolfo, Connecticut bias warning, but Peter Grandolfo is a Connecticut kid, went to Fairfield Prep here. He's a freshman and played with their top midfield group. And he is a very good dodger, looked very comfortable at the college level as a dodger already. He even drew a pole at times in their games. So kind of shows you the respect and where he already stands. Sean Berrigan and Luke Brunner both had a couple of goals against Monmouth and two more freshmen there. So a really, really bright future, I think, for Bucknell with this freshman class that they have. Definitely some offensive firepower there. Bucknell is also a team that, you know, they were in the 10-man ride a lot. They were doubling very aggressively on defense. They try and slide quickly and aggressively to kind of disrupt your offense and keep you on your heels as much as you can. So they're a fun team to watch for sure. They're very much the style of play they have is aggressive in all phases. And it's definitely was fun to watch Bucknell. Monmouth, they played Bucknell in their first game. They played Lehigh in their second game. So two good tests for Monmouth. Bucknell kind of jumped on them early. Some of this was, I think this kind of happened in a lot of the games, but the team that was playing their first game and then the team that was playing their second game, the team that was in their second game was basically like warmed up and at game speed and comfortable playing against somebody who's like had just warmed up kind of next to the field and was kind of getting loose, you know, for whatever, 20 minutes on the field before the game started. So, Bucknell obviously jumped all over Monmouth early because Monmouth still looked like they were kind of cold. But I thought Monmouth, once they kind of got into a groove a little bit, played the Bison pretty tough the rest of the way. I thought Monmouth looked really sharp against Lehigh. Again, like once they got into their second game and their flow, you know, I thought they looked more comfortable. Their defense, you know, definitely toughened up. They held Lehigh scoreless for an entire quarter. Lehigh, it looked like they kind of took the approach in this game of, we're going to play a lot of our young guys and more of our backups and those type players against Monmouth for three quarters. And then we'll use the running time quarter for our starters to warm up. And then we're going to play Hopkins with our starters against their starters in the second game. So it looked like that was kind of Lehigh's approach there. But for Monmouth, I thought Connor McCray looked really good. He had a hat trick against Bucknell. He's one of their top scorers that's returning. He ran the point really well on the break. He's a very heads-up attackman. Shoots pretty well. I thought Matt Dolliv, I hope I'm saying your name right, Matt Dolliv, but he transferred from Rutgers. He's 6'2", 200, and runs bigger than that. Like Bucknell really had a hard time matching up with him physically. So him as a dodger at attack or out of the midfield even, you know, he was really putting a lot of pressure on the defense. Andrew Coleman and Nett, you know, he got the start in that first game, made some good saves, but was basically getting shelled and under a ton of fire early from Bucknell. Cody Lavin, as a freshman, got the second half, and I thought he was pretty impressive. So, you know, I think Monmouth looked decent in net. Against Lehigh, Monmouth has a Marquette transfer, Connor Gorman, who is another guy who's a big body, you know, 6'4", 200. He was a force, had a couple of goals from the left side. He was consistently drawing slides. So I thought he looked good as well. Monmouth did have a hard time dealing with Bucknell's 10-man ride, as you would expect. The games are getting played on whatever, October 7th, 8th, whatever it was. You know, teams are not going to be that ready, or in a rainstorm in particular, against the 10-man ride. So Monmouth also had an LSM, Hayden Chester, who scored a goal, who was really, really good on wings and in transition. And they had a defenseman. I thought Miles Edmiston stood out pretty well. He's really, really good in coverage. Drew top matchup for them at times, and he really hunts it well in the clear. He finds lanes upfield to run transition off of saves really well. Had a nice opportunity out of that where he went on, you know, didn't get picked up on the break and let a shot go, and just a good save kind of robbed him of a goal. But he ran the field well for sure. For Lehigh, I thought, you know, their first game again was against Monmouth. They're a team with, you know, new coach in Will Scudder. Graduation of Mike Sisselberger, their leading scorer from last year, Christian Millet, is playing for Duke this year as a grad transfer. So definitely some question marks for Lehigh coming into this game. But I thought they looked pretty solid. Again, they played a lot of their younger, inexperienced, and more backup guys against Monmouth. So like Scott Cole and Richard Checo and those guys really didn't play in the first game. They have a freshman, Trevor Broughtons, who I thought looked pretty good. But really, when you got into that Hopkins game, when that game faced off, it did not feel like October. Those teams were playing each other like it was March. They were playing hard. The intensity was there. Guys were getting after it physically. There was some talk after whistles. There was, you know, aggressive play. I thought Andrew Kelly and Dakota Ehrman, again, forgive me on names. I did not have a pronunciation guide for this, and I did not know Dakota very well before this game. They combined, I think, for 7 goals against Hopkins. They looked really good. Freddie Amato from the midfield, really nice heads-up dodger. He had a goal as well. They were solid in net with Nick Pecora. So, you know, a major question, obviously, for Lehigh all year is going to be at the face-off spot. How do you deal with the fact that maybe, you know, a top 2-3 at worst face-off specialist in college lacrosse history graduated? But, you know, they had a couple of guys who looked good. Sean Dow or Doe, again, forgive me, D-O-W, Sean, I'm sorry. But Sean played very, very well against Hopkins, won a lot of big draws for them. There were plays where Hopkins went to a man-up face-off and they couldn't get the ball because they couldn't win the draw against Sean. So I thought he looked really good. And then Johnny Kidd took a bunch of draws against Monmouth, scored a goal in that game off the face-off, started a bunch of breaks. Both those guys were able to start breaks well, win the ball to themselves, win it forward when they could. And they both, I thought, showed that they were skilled enough to make opponents have to respect them as goal scorers. It's not the old just like, nobody slides me or attackman and let him shoot. You have to think about going to these guys because they both put good shots on net. Like I said, Kidd scored a goal. I think the faceoff spot looked pretty good for Lehigh, for a team that's trying to figure out life without Mike Sisselberger. So, obviously, Richard Checo was a standout. I didn't bother trying to count all the caused turnovers and ground balls. Nobody was keeping stats for this, but he was all over the ball off the ground. He's a special defenseman. For Hopkins, they played the last two games of the day. Like I said, they played Lehigh and Hofstra. The Lehigh game had, I thought, regular season intensity. Chase Erlin got the start for them in net, as you would expect. Cornell transfer, made a bunch of highlight saves early. The first one he made, he dropped down low, caught it with his foot, you know, kind of went to like a split, like you would see like a Dylan Ward kind of save. But he really was pushing transition, pushing tempo off of saves, trying to, you know, get the ball up the field and getting them, you know, attacking and transition as much as they can. Brandon Aviles, who transferred from Syracuse, I thought looked really, really good for them. He is a really strong short stick D-middy. I thought their stars kind of performed as you would expect against Lehigh. You know, Russell Melendez had a goal. Degnan had a goal. Peschko had a goal. Brooks English had a couple of goals. Collison had a bunch of really good looks, couldn't finish any, but he played some really nice two-man lacrosse with Peschko. Eric Chick had a late goal for them. He looked solid. With all those stars though, Jimmy Ayers went straight into the starting lineup. He started at attack with Melendez and Degnan. I don't think Angeles played at all. I know these teams all are banged up. They're all already dealing with injuries, but did not see Angeles out there. So I'm assuming he's one of those guys who's hurt. But I thought Jimmy Ayers, you know, he showed a really, really explosive first step and separated from defensemen really well. And he dodges with his head up and he was looking to feed. So I thought he looked comfortable. And he looked ready to compete, you know, at that level with those players. Against Lehigh, I thought the Hopkins defense played fast, played aggressive. Scott Smith, a standout, particularly off the ground in transition. I personally did not have a good enough appreciation for just how fast he is and how quickly he gets the ball up the field. But he looked really, really good. Obviously, you know, we mentioned Erland there. Hopkins also had this thing. They were doubling and playing aggressive to the, like, you know, Jackson Raposo unfortunately got hurt in the scrimmage and didn't return. But before he got hurt, there were plays where he was on the ball and Aviles went and doubled. And, you know, a two short stick double team is not something that's often executed well or even advised, but Hopkins looked willing to do it with those two, which I think tells you a lot about Aviles. Again, he was the doubler, just knowing where to be and how to kind of squish that matchup and you know, squeeze the offensive player between them and put the ball on the ground. So they had a couple of plays like that I thought looked really good. Against Hofstra, Hopkins got out to a much slower start. They just had one first quarter goal. In the second goal, they got absolutely steamrolled by the Hofstra offense. They gave up 8 goals in the quarter alone. They kept it close in the third, and then they beat them up. They beat up Hofstra pretty good, 4-0 in the fourth. By that time, it was mostly backups and kind of kids out there. Melendez and Smith and Erland all didn't play in the Hofstra matchup, so that's kind of a qualifier there for the beating. But I thought Hopkins. I don't know if you want to make that a question then about their depth, about their younger guys, and if they're going to be deep enough to do damage in a tournament, whether if they have to deal with injuries and stuff like that, because that Hofstra first group really, really was pouring it on there for a little while. But again, Hofstra, we can talk Hofstra for a second here. They played in the first game and the last game of the day. So they had this kind of this long 4-hour break, 5-hour break, whatever it was between their first and last game. So they played Bucknell in the first game of the day, and then they closed the day with Hopkins. I thought Ryan Woodland looked really good for Hofstra. He is a tall, like kind of lean and rangy attackman who can just kind of play his angles and his, get to spots on the field well. He had looked good, I think, for them a couple times last year, but, I think some injuries kind of kept him off the field. John Madsen is an offensive leader for them. He was one of their top scorers last year. He'll be one of their top offensive players this year, I think. Trey Parks paired really, really well with Woodland. They ran some really nice two-man games. Parks, I think, had 4 goals against Hopkins. When you think about that offensive – again, they had an 8-goal quarter against Hopkins. Hofstra also was missing some serious weapons. Kane didn't play. Colton Rudd, I don't think, played. Those are guys who were banged up. Those are two of Hofstra's top 3 scorers from a year ago. Coach Tierney said in the postgame, 4 players who started at Hofstra at some point last year didn't play in either scrimmage. So I think you get a feel that Hofstra's depth on offense, I think, is looking pretty solid. They have a really good LSM transfer from North Carolina, JT Rozelle, who was really good in transition and off of wings. He's a really solid player, I think, who's going to be an impact guy for them. I think a question for Hofstra this year coming in was going to be in net. Sean Henderson started both games for them. They have a Muhlenberg transfer, a D3 guy, Max May, who had, you know, some great years at Muhlenberg and I think is battling for that job. Shea Kennedy, Jimmy Van Meter, or other goalies on the roster, all of them got some play. It looked like it was Sean and Max as kind of the top 2 guys. In the postgame, Tierney said that if they had a game tomorrow, Henderson would be the starter. But he said he said he appreciated the value in having these other guys right there pushing him. So, I think that's a fun spot to watch. And then Chase Patterson, their faceoff guy, Hofstra's faceoff guy, was really good. He torched Hopkins at the faceoff spot. Really, really had a hell of a game there. Didn't do as well in the first game. Bucknell took it to them at the faceoff spot, and Hofstra tried a few different guys, even though Patterson is definitely going to be their guy. But, I think Hofstra, I am kind of bullish on now. I liked what I saw a lot from them, given, again, that it's October and there's a lot to learn and there's a lot to execute better. But in terms of their depth of weapons and the guys you saw and considering the guys who weren't in the lineup for them, I think you can feel pretty good about where the Pride are. That's a team that brought back a lot of guys that were young last year. They're still in a lot of spots, you know, pretty young this year. Parks, I think, is a sophomore. You know, freshman to sophomore year, he's really elevated, at least through what we've seen so far. So, yeah, that was the Collier Classic. I very much enjoyed that. Was happy to be there. I did write up a lot of this and a lot of takeaways with some, you know, some quotes from coaches and stuff like that for Inside Lacrosse. I imagine that'll be up soon. I think the plan was for that to be up today, but as you might have realized, there was some other lacrosse news today, so it might have just gotten pushed to the back burner a little bit. But yeah, I think, you know, again, all the squads that were there had players that I would buy a ticket to see for sure. But yeah, I really enjoyed, even through the shitty weather, I thought it was a really fun event. And, you know, tens of thousands of dollars were raised for the foundation, so obviously that's a win all around. Nothing to complain about there. Finally, I will say, as we kind of talk fall ball, but I did drop a piece on sticksinlacrosse.com about transfer players that I am very excited to watch in the fall and as the season gets here. But if you're curious about some guys in the portal and all that, you can check that out. It's super easy to be like, yeah, I can't wait to watch like the super blue chip guys, like the Princeton guy who's transferring to wherever, to Duke, you know, whatever it is. Of course, there's some of those that are in there, like, who wouldn't be excited to watch that? But I did try to call out also some of the D2 and D3 guys who are going to D1 schools who maybe haven't gotten the eyeballs on them, either because it was just D2 or D3, or it was like a deep cut of a D2 or D3 guy that maybe, you know, you might have missed if you didn't watch that much lacrosse, but should be on your radar now for sure as we get into the D1 year of their career. I'm always going to be a fan of the way the portal allows these players to make the move that's best for them and their college experience. I think the chaos that it has wrought on college athletics in general is kind of just part of the fun for me. Again, I'm just a big portal fan. I think, you know, you see the top schools in lacrosse getting aggressive in the portal, and I think you can understand why, right? It's, you think about it, like, how do you not, all right, we'll go to Coach Prime because nobody crushes the portal quite like Dion. He's the undisputed king of the NCAA transfer portal. But he, I think, has spoken about having a thought process that's basically like, why would I bother going to look at high school kids? I can just go to the portal and get a college kid who's got experience and has ability. What do I need high school kids for? I don't think lacrosse is quite there yet. We're not at Coach Prime levels quite of portal, abuse and leveraging quite like Coach Prime does, but it's an interesting way to think about it. If you have a need, why would you recruit somebody for the need? Just go to the portal and get somebody. But different discussion for another day. One other piece that's up on Sticks In right now, my 10 favorite stories from the PLL season, kind of my little putting a bow on the end of things for the PLL there. You know, the Cannons, I thought the face-off story was obviously huge. Some, you know, big team struggling, new stars. It's kind of all in there. So you can check that out. In terms of future PLL content, there isn't a ton on the horizon. The PLL does have a golf outing. It's PLL Assists, I should say, has a golf outing that's, you know, raising money for charity and for causes that they support. So I'm going to try and offer some coverage to that if I can, because it does seem like a really cool, again, positive, you know, raising money for worthy causes is never something you can be upset about. So going to try and check out the PLL Assists golf outing that's happening at some point in October here. I will be down in Baltimore for the Fall Classic this weekend to see Team USA, see Team Canada, and they're going to mix it up with Penn State along with each other. So I think that's all the more fun now, given the Olympic news, that you get to see Team USA this weekend on the heels of this Olympic thing. If you're going to be in Baltimore to check it out, tickets are available. You can just go. It's an open thing. It's not like some private event. You can buy a ticket and go see these games. But give me a shout if you're in the area or if you know good places to eat. I'm always in the market for those. It's at USA Lacrosse headquarters in Sparks. So I don't know the geography very well, but I'm staying nearby there somewhere. So that is going to be it for today, though. Thank you again for sticking around with me. Lacrosse, playing in the Olympics, folks. It's coming. I'm so excited. Thank you again. We'll see you next time.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus chews.
This episode is brought to you by Paycor, the HR and payroll software made for leaders. It's never been harder to recruit, hire, and engage workers. That's why HR leaders and frontline managers depend on Paycor for all things people management, from onboarding and performance reviews to compensation and benefits. Learn more at paycor.com/leaders. That's paycor.com/leaders.
She said, get out the chat room and clean mine.
Glad Stretch, feeling fine, so fresh.
The Glad Girl Group coming at you with a throwback jam. That was Glad Force Flex Drawstring Trash Bags featuring Pine Sol Original Scent. And that's better than all good. It's all Glad.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.